Good evening. Thank you so much for being here, members and visitors. I was made aware this evening before services that I appear to have collected a bit of a reputation for sermon titles that are provocative or intriguing or angering. I don't know exactly what the word is, but grabbing people's attention. And I don't necessarily deny that or apologize for that. If I hope it doesn't distract from anything during worship services, obviously. But I did want to talk about food for a little bit. And I hope everybody ate really well this afternoon. We'll have a conversation about food here today. And then stick with me in about 35 minutes or so. We'll dismiss and we'll have the Lord's Supper. And then you go ahead and have a hamburger or something. Anyway, although after this conversation, you may not want a hamburger. We'll get to that in a second. There, sociologists, I think, like coming up with names for things. I think scientists in general like to do this. It makes it more likely to get quoted in the New Yorker or the Atlantic or something like that. At some point, a few years ago, someone came up with the term food deserts. And this is a term, maybe you've heard this term. This describes a place in the world, and occasionally even places in America, where there's just not access to food, at least not access to good food. And there are places where the easiest place for somebody to shop for food is at Dollar General or at the Circle K or something like that, which is clearly very limited choices. The food that you have is not very good. That's unfortunate, and we try as a society to limit those food deserts as much as we possibly can. More recently, there is a term that has come up that caught my attention, the term food swamps. And this is a slightly different concept. A food swamp is where there's a lot of food, but all the food, there's an extreme preponderance of food that is bad for you. And this bad fast food and that sort of thing, there's so much access to bad food, it becomes economically difficult to provide good food in these situations. All the fresh market type places and such get pushed out because everybody's going to McDonald's or Burger King or whatever. That's unfortunate. And it's tragic in our, especially in American society, where we produce the world's food, essentially, where we are not able to get food to people who need it the most, or even worse, perhaps, you have people who have access to good food and choose junk instead. Now, that may or may not be a problem in your mind. But what I'd like to do is play with that thought a little bit and talk primarily about spiritual things. Now, if you go home from this with an attitude toward, I need to improve my diet, I need to eat better, then by all means go ahead and do that. The kids who like to eat ding-dongs for dinner, this may not be your kind of sermon. And I'm just, brace you for that. At any rate, the main point, though, is a spiritual one. And what I'd like to do, first of all, is talk about the difference between food and nutrition. I remember seeing some article someplace where they were talking about oatmeal and what actually constitutes food. And that oatmeal gives a good example of what is and isn't food. You look at oats, for instance. Oats are not food. Humans don't eat food. Horses eat oats. Now, you mill that into still-ground oatmeal, that's food. Standard Quaker oats that you cook for 3 minutes, that's food. Quick oats, that's kind of food. You're getting further and further away from something that's actually nutritious. You get the packet things with this full of sugar and preservatives and dried out blueberries, that's not food. We've gone too far to the other extreme here. That's just something that you can eat, but it's not going to do your body any good. There's a difference between something that you can, in fact, ingest that will get in your system and do some metabolic stuff, and something that's actually helping you out. The junk food that we're talking about here may fill you up, and may give you the short-term satisfaction that eating provides, but it doesn't necessarily help your body, and it may in fact be doing more harm than good. By doing this, we are robbing ourselves, generally, of real nutrition. When we fill ourselves up with ice cream or pork rinds or whatever it is that you're into these days, you don't have an appetite anymore, and so therefore you're not inclined to eat the things that you actually need to eat. And so therefore you wind up starving yourself when you're full of food, or what pretends to be food anyway. The void in our life is full of these tasty but worthless treats. And worse than that is we become satisfied with this and we become addicted to this. And there's all kinds of studies about this. And again, studies that you read about on Facebook, I'm not sure exactly how much credence you want to put into this. But there's certainly a lot of scientific evidence to indicate that sugar and processed food and that sort of thing has not only a metabolic effect on your body, but also a mental effect. That you actually start craving these kind of things and you become less and less likely to seek out the food that your body actually needs. You're more and more satisfied with the things that are in fact poisoning you. And you become less and less healthy, and it just kind of compounds itself, gets worse and worse as time goes by. So what we're basically doing is poisoning ourselves, gorging ourselves, and poisoning ourselves with what we are calling food. Now, we're going to talk about exactly how bad that might be in the short term and how bad it might be in the long term. But again, the main point here is a spiritual point. If we can agree that eating is not the same thing as nourishing yourself in a physical sense, the main point here is that eating spiritually is not necessarily the same thing as feeding your soul. There is an abundance of what claims to be spiritual food in our society. There's never been a culture that had so much access to so much food of a spiritual nature. And the best example, of course, of that is the Bible. The Bible is readily available unless you go to Target. It's very, very easy to come by. Everybody, it's online. It's in various versions, various dialects and languages. If you are not able to read the Bible, you're just not trying very hard. The Bible is readily available to you at whatever kind of reading level you want to have. And in addition to that, there is an unprecedented amount of Bible-related content. You go to Barnes & Noble or Walmart or whatever, you go to the religious section and it's just wall-to-wall books. All this stuff that is related to the Bible in some fashion, some more related than others. But all of it claiming to be spiritual content, if you read this, you're going to grow closer to God. Which may or may not be the truth. But I think we would all agree that at its core, nothing is the same thing as the Bible. The Bible is, you know, sanctify them in truth. Your word is truth. Jesus prayed in John 17, verse 17. That is the real spiritual nutrition. There may be other things that can get us by, but no matter what it is, if it does not have its core in the Bible, it can't possibly be nutritious for us. It's not possible for this to be the case. There's a lot of pop psychology in modern, but this comes up in part because I've been doing a lot more reading this year. If you follow my podcast, you know that there's a segment that I do where I'm reading something. And sometimes it's some kind of secular book. Maybe a book that has a spiritual overtone or whatever. That it's intended specifically to bring somebody closer to God. It's not always that way, but sometimes it is. And these books are sometimes very profitable and sometimes not so much. And lots of times what you have really is more psychology than you have Bible. Now, if you understand what you're reading, that's not necessarily, damaging any more than a scoop of ice cream after dinner is necessarily damaging to what you're doing. But are we seeing this as our source of nutrition? Have we confused this human stuff with what is actually nutritious? In Colossians chapter 2 and verse number 8, part of the problem that we have in the Lord's church is the same as they had back then. Paul writes here, "See to it that no one take you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of this world, rather than according to Christ." Now, human psychology and biblical psychology are not always at opposition to one another. We all understand that, I think. Just because a human came up with it doesn't mean it's wrong. But it sure doesn't mean it's right. And what Paul is saying here is that we can, if we're not careful, fall victim to this empty deception according to the tradition of men. And that's the key to it. When it, at its core, has its fundamental theology, its fundamental psychology, its fundamental roots in human wisdom and human origins rather than the Bible, then you got junk food here. And it's not going to ultimately draw you closer to God. It may draw you closer to some teacher, but not closer to God. Speaking of pseudo-religion, there are various passages that refer to this. We talked about 1 Timothy this week. One of the passages is in 1 Timothy in chapter 4, verse 1 and following. And he's writing in the first century, by the way. Remember, this is 2,000 years ago almost when Paul is writing this. But the Spirit explicitly says that in later times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons by means of the hypocrisy of liars seared in their own consciences with a branding iron, men who forbid marriage and advocate abstaining from foods which God has created to be gratefully shared by those who believe and know the truth. For everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be received and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with gratitude. That's the blessing that God gives us. The good teaching, as it were. And there's going to come along these people who are teaching something else. And I don't know if Paul is talking here specifically about false teachers that are going to come up in Timothy's lifetime, or whether he's talking about things that are going to happen at some specific point, some specific time in the future. I think he's probably talking more just in general terms about how this is the way the world works, and this is the way the world works in the church. That there are going to be people who come along who are going to corrupt the gospel, who are going to twist it and mangle it for their own purposes so that they can achieve some kind of short-term carnal goal. It's not the same thing as the gospel. It's going to look like the gospel. I refer lots of times to the false prophet in Revelation 13, which I believe is deliberately couched in this language to make it look like the Lamb. The Lamb is Jesus, of course. And here's a beast out of the earth that has horns like the Lamb does, and it has... You know, it talks like, it sounds kind of like Jesus. That's what the way the false prophet is. He's an imitator, deliberately imitating. Not so you can be drawn closer to Jesus, but so that you can be drawn closer to the beast. Closer to the beast out of the sea. That's what false teaching is going to do for us. It may sound good, it may sound like the Bible. I had an interesting conversation a couple months ago now. With a woman who was talking about this Bible that she had read, and she mentioned the name of it, and I don't remember what the name was. I hadn't heard of it, which is strange. I've heard of a lot of versions of the Bible. If you've been in my office, you know I have a dozen or so. And she said, this Bible is really good, because sometimes when you read the Bible, it's difficult to understand. You know, and this one kind of simplifies the language a lot and brings it down to earth, and it's a lot easier to read, and I enjoy reading it. I'm kind of nodding my head. It's okay, I get that. But, you know, a little warning lights are going off in the back of my head here. Just because it's easier to... And I haven't seen any kind of doctrinal problems with it at all. Well, maybe there's not any doctrinal problems with it at all. I don't know. But I do know that just because it's easier to read doesn't mean it's more accurate. Or even as accurate. And I know for a fact, and I can give you some names if you want the names, of Bibles that are aiming specifically toward readability, or at least claim to be, leaning toward readability, toward easy access, that sort of thing, which are not especially interested in content. They're not especially interested in accuracy. They are, in many instances, consciously or unconsciously, teaching a false doctrine, or at least leading the reader in that direction. So we need to be careful about even what calls itself the Bible. And certainly we need to be careful about that which does not call itself the Bible, but calls it biblically based or even worse, spiritual. That's a word that is horribly, horribly misused in the modern day. People consider themselves to be spiritual writers. Rarely is a person like that going to tell you need to read your Bible more. That's just not the way that word is usually used in the modern day. Anyway, that's another tirade for another day. Ultimately, all of this is a different, a lesser gospel. And Paul tells us specifically in Galatians chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, about what's going to happen to the one who advocates this other gospel. He's being cursed, the text says. There is no other gospel as far as Paul's concerned. This is the only one that's going to save people. It is the only power of God to salvation, Romans 1, verse 16. And so, therefore, we must adhere to that gospel. Now, that's going to come... There are probably going to be a lot of vegetable references in the lesson here this evening. So, kids, I apologize ahead of time for this. Okay, I get that sometimes eating your vegetables is just not what you want to do. I used to be 8 years old also. I used to not like eating my vegetables. There are times, if you put a gun to my head and make me tell the truth, there are times in the modern day when I don't especially like to eat my vegetables, depending on the vegetable. But here's the deal. You get to be a grown-up, and hopefully you realize that there are certain things that need to be done. And if you do them enough, you might actually develop a taste for it. When you're 8 years old, you don't get that. You don't care to get that. Your parents understand. They're not asking you to like your Brussels sprouts. They're just telling you to eat your Brussels sprouts. Okay, and if you're like our kids, they'll put up a fuss as far as that kind of thing goes. That's okay. We don't mind that so much. You'll eat them anyway. And then we'll get on with our life. The pudding comes after the meal. That's the way that it works. And the meal includes the things that you don't especially want to eat. Jesus asks us to eat the gospel. Yes, it's to eat the bread of life. To consume in quantity the true and living word of God. And being able to do that, that will teach us how to fill our bodies with something good, to fill our minds, fill our spirits with something good, so that we're able to put this junk stuff in its proper place, which may very well be on the shelf instead of on the plate. And we're able to properly process this so we can grow into the kind of person that God wants us to be. That's the difference between food and nutrition. Now, this brings up a few questions, and I want to deal with some of this. Because I hear this a lot with parents of 20-somethings get all judgy about parents with preteens. Okay, I apologize for that. That may be the way I come across here. I'm not trying to tell you how to live your life here. But we have been through this war before. Now, we understand how this works. We understand the excuses. We made the excuses. In some of the cases, we probably invented the excuses. But here's the deal. Lots of times, families will, in fact, opt for junk instead of actual food. And the comeback is, well, this is what they'll eat. They eat macaroni and cheese. You know, they'll eat Twinkies. They'll eat ice cream. You know, this is not what we would want. We want them to eat arugula and you know, rutabagas and all. That's what we want them to eat. But they don't want to eat those things. So surely it's better to eat something rather than eating nothing. Is that true? Well, in a sense, in the short term, maybe. My question is, why are we asking the question? Why are we asking the question of whether it's better to eat junk than eat nothing? Is there not a preferable option to those two? Are we really in a position where it's got to be either junk or nothing? I think in most situations, if not all situations, there are options available to us. What happens oftentimes, the reason that children don't eat the vegetables is because they've become addicted to the ice cream and the Twinkies and the donuts and all that kind of thing. That they love the other so much, what is bad for them, that they are incapable of processing properly in their minds the concept of the good things. This has spiritual roots. We talked about the deeds of the flesh a few moments ago when we read from Galatians chapter 5. These bad things that are afflicting us as spiritual beings are here because we do not have enough of the Spirit in us. We have not acquired a taste for the good things, and therefore we have adopted these bad things. And we're killing ourselves with these things. What eventually happens is we become repellent. The good things become repellent to us. If I, you know, if you give the child, you get the vegetable course, and you get the meat course, and you get the dessert, and you put them out there in three plates and say, okay, here's your dinner. Go ahead. What are they going to do? They're going to eat the dessert, right? And then what's going to happen when they get to the vegetables? What are they going to say? I'm too full. Yep. I don't have any room for it. I'm full. I can't eat. Well, that may not be a lie. That may actually be true. That they have glutted themselves with the bad things to the point where they're incapable of processing the good things. We need to avoid that, obviously. That's a bad idea. These are problems that need to be fixed. And every parent will know this. Every parent will admit this. The question is, when do you want to fix the problem? Do you want to fix the problem when the child is 6? Do you want to fix the problem when they're 16? Or do you want to fix it when they're 26? You can choose. You got a lot more control over the 6-year-old than you do over the 16-year-old. I don't know what the thinking that you can fix these problems when they're older and they have a will of their own and they have 10 years of practice behind them rather than when they're little. Well, then eat your vegetables or go to bed hungry, you know, whatever you want to do. It's not so much a matter of the child being incapable of doing the wrong thing. It's a matter of the grown-up not finding the proper way to motivate the child to do the right thing. And the same thing is going to be true with regard to the gospel. Is something better than nothing? It depends. Maybe not. Well, the Bible is just too much for me, so I like reading Max Dawson books, or I like reading Joel Osteen books, or I could name some other names. I probably shouldn't do that. But I like reading the spiritual content. I like reading the you know, those novels that they write about Ruth or Esther. Usually it's women, because the women are the ones reading these things. These novels that are based on the life of the person in the Bible. That really makes it come alive for me. It's easier for me to read these fictionalized stories than to read the actual Bible. Does that mean it's bad to read the other one? I'm not saying it's bad, necessarily. But if it's taking the place of the Bible, yes, it's bad. And it very well may be doing more harm than good in our quest for so-called spirituality, so-called religion and knowledge. We convince ourselves oftentimes that if we get this little bit of so-called spiritual nutrition, that we don't in fact need any more. We're done. We're full. We got everything that we need. That's why Paul warns the elders, the Ephesian elders in Acts chapter 20. He talks about, I did not shrink from declaring you the whole purpose of God in verse number 22, or 27 rather. I think I meant verse number 22. I meant to write verse 27, that is. I did not shrink from declaring to you the whole purpose of God. Everything that God has to offer. Now that doesn't mean you spend, you know, as much time in Isaiah as you spend in Acts necessarily, but there is a way for you to process what God has given you, and we need to give one another, and including our children, an opportunity to do exactly that. If we get used to this light treatment of the gospel, if we get used to what pretends to be, what claims to be the gospel is not the real thing, oftentimes we find ourselves with such weak knowledge of God's will that we misapply the knowledge that we do have. And we wind up misunderstanding what the clear teachings of the Bible are. Baptism for remission of sins is probably the best example of this. I've got three study Bibles now, I think, two or three. So I'm not a big fan of study Bibles, as you well know. And one of the reasons is, invariably, I'll open up my study Bible, and I'll be reading Acts 2:38, or I'll be reading Galatians 3:27, or 1 Peter 3, verse 21, or whatever that means to me. And there'll be the, you know, three or four paragraphs. Baptism is not actually necessary for salvation. You know, let's talk. I realize this is said, it's certainly a commandment of God that every believer ought to be baptized. Usually they'll go that far. But it's not part of your salvation process. You don't have to be baptized in order to be saved. Well, if that's what I'm used to reading, if I read that kind of thing every time I read Acts 2:38 or whatever, maybe I come away with a lack of understanding, an improper understanding of what the Bible actually teaches. I've always maintained that if you cut away all the comments and cut away all the human stuff and just read the Bible, you'll be able to figure out what the Bible's trying to tell you. It may take a little bit more work than reading the comments or reading the commentary or reading the fiction or whatever, but you can do this. You're capable of doing this. If we get used to reading the easy stuff, we may find ourselves in a position where we're incapable of understanding the hard stuff. At its core, ultimately, this is about doing what we want to do. And this is why 8-year-olds don't set the menu. Now, there may be an occasional glorious day in your family when the 8-year-olds get to set the menu. Have you ever done that in your family? You can imagine what you would get, right? Oh, man, it's got to be great. We're going to have donuts stuffed with chocolate and ice cream on top, and it's going to be this glorious extravaganza of saturated fat. It's going to be this marvelous. And maybe one day it is. And maybe if you do that one day every 5 years, it's not going to kill your family, depending on how much saturated fat you're talking about. But generally speaking, we know in the big picture, you just can't run your life like that. You can't run your family's diet like that. You're going to kill somebody in the short term probably doing that. Children aren't capable of making decisions like that. And if we will not allow children to set their physical diet, their carnal diet, why in the world would we let them set their spiritual diet? Parents are supposed to know what's best. They're supposed to be bringing up their children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. We're supposed to be finding what is pleasing to the Lord, not what's pleasing to the kids, not what's pleasing to us, but what's pleasing to the Lord. That's what Ephesians 5 and verse 10 says. That's what we need to be focusing on. Now, second question. Is it really that big of a deal? And I've argued this, and I don't entirely disagree with this. How important is nutrition for little kids. How important is it that six-year-olds eat parchments? And my answer is I'm not sure. I'm genuinely not sure about that. There is a school of thought among many, especially families that have working mothers where there's just not a lot of time to make nutritious four-course meals that are really good for the child. There is a school of thought, well, you know, if they'll eat the grilled cheese sandwiches and the macaroni and cheese and the frozen burritos, if that's what they will eat, if they're willing to do that, then go ahead and give it to them, and they'll learn good habits later on. You know, I didn't learn to appreciate vegetables until I got bigger. You probably didn't either. It's not that big of a reach to think, well, maybe this kind of problem just fixes itself in the long term. Maybe we just keep them alive for 18 years. Manage not to kill them. And then when they go off on their own, then they'll work all this stuff out. Well, maybe so. Maybe so. I would suggest to you, though, that we owe our children better than that. That it's not enough to make sure our kids don't die in our charge in the short term. That we can and we should offer more to them than that. It is our responsibility as parents. And as far as the learning good habits, it doesn't tend to work that way. I'm not saying it doesn't work that way. I said I didn't like eating vegetables. I didn't learn how to appreciate vegetables until I got older. I was made to eat my vegetables. Growing up. And I'm not sure exactly how much I ate or how much compared to Taylor or Kylie that I ate or whatever, and I'm not sure it matters really. But the idea that I ate no vegetables for 18 years and then I went off to college and I started eating vegetables, that's not the way it works. Not on planet Earth, not in my experience. And not in yours either, I suspect. These good habits happen when you train good habits into somebody. Whether it's waking up on time, whether it's exercising, whether it's, you know, having a smile when you greet somebody at work, whatever it happens to be, good habits tend to be created deliberately and ideally at a very early stage. And certainly that's true with regard to food. And even if it did, even if they did fix themselves, why would we deliberately make things more difficult for the child than is necessary? If your child has never seen a bite in his life, and he turns 18 years old and he goes off to college, and now he has to fix all these problems that have been created for 18 years, let's say he can do it. Let's say he develops this amazing affinity for turning greens when he goes off to college or whatever. Let's say he does. It's not going to happen overnight. It might happen after a year or 5 years or 10 years or whatever. Why are we making it more difficult than it has to be for the children? Why not give them a little bit of introduction to the healthy life? Or just throw them headfirst into it if your family works that way, however it works. But allow them to get a toehold into the proper way of doing things so that when it comes time for them to make good decisions, they have the tools already. And maybe they become healthy early instead of becoming healthy later, if ever. Failing to do that, I won't get too personal with this. Let's be honest about this. And I can speak from experience here. I'm indicting myself as much as anybody else. Sometimes we have Twinkies for dinner because mom and dad like Twinkies. Right? If mom and dad didn't like Twinkies, we would figure out a way to not do this. Because ultimately we're in charge, right? It may very well be, moms and dads, that the reason we give in to the children's whims, the children's tastes, that we know are not necessarily in their best interest long term, the reason we give in is because we ourselves are not as strong as we ought to be. And that you shouldn't be surprised necessarily when I turn that into spiritual direction. This is the problem with regard to our spiritual upbringing of children. God requires us to bring up our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. This is our job. I know it says fathers, but mothers, that's you too. We have a job to do to make sure that our children are trained properly. And the way they're trained properly, the way they become spiritually healthy, is by eating spiritual food, eating the bread of life. That means that we make the decisions. It aggravates me to no end when I hear parents of 14-year-olds saying, well, the child I'd love for the child to come to Bible class, but the child doesn't really get much out of that. And ultimately, he's big enough to make his own decisions anyway. And so I'm trying to create an environment for that child where he'll make this decision on his own rather than just doing it because I told him to do it. I've seen that strategy fail and fail and fail and fail and fail. Over and over again, I've never seen it succeed. If your idea of success is your child learning how to serve God properly. And we don't take that strategy with anything else. You know, my kid doesn't really get much out of Alabama. He thinks it's kind of pointless. And, you know, and Graham, it is. So he doesn't want to go to school this morning, so he's not going to go to school. And it's just not appropriate for me to kind of, you know, urge him along to do something he's not comfortable with. So I'm going to let him go at his own pace. And if he's not comfortable with school, I'll just wait around until he's ready to be comfortable with school. And then he'll do it for his own reasons instead of my reasons. Any parents that sound like malpractice, parent malpractice out there? We don't do that. You know, smoke marijuana maybe wouldn't be my first choice. Maybe I'd rather him not do that. But you know what? He's 15 years old. He needs to make these kind of decisions himself. He needs to work this out on his own. No, he doesn't. Not in my house, anyway. I bet not in your house, either. If that is the case with regard to those things, why do we allow children to decide whether they're going to read their Bible or not? Why do we let the children decide whether they're going to attend church services or not? This is not their decision to make. This is the parents' decision to make. And we would love for the kids to go without screaming and hollering. That would be great. But if screaming and hollering is necessary to get the job done, we'll take the screaming and hollering. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Doesn't sound like Joshua has a whole lot of options there for his, by the way, grown children that he's talking to about here. Children and grandchildren. And probably great-grandchildren at this point. Taking responsibility. This is the way my family operates. And it's incumbent upon parents to take this responsibility, to set the spiritual guidelines for their families, making those decisions. And that's going to involve saying no. I know it's a lot easier to say yes. You get a lot more hugs, you get a lot more smiles, you get a lot less yelling when you say yes. Can we have donuts for dinner? Sure. Oh, you're the greatest dad in the world. Thank you so much. That's very, very refreshing and rewarding in the short term. That's not my job as a parent. My job is not to make my child happy. I'm not trying to make my child unhappy necessarily, but whatever works, right? My job is to save my child's life, to train my child to be a grown-up in due course of time. And with regard to spiritual things, my job is to make sure that the child does what's right and is stopped when he is threatening or she is threatening her own spiritual safety. Is it okay for me to stay home from church service? No, it's not. Is it okay for me to put off my Bible reading? No, it's not. You're going to do what you need to do. But I don't feel like it. Well, I'm real sorry about that. You're going to do it anyway. Well, I hate you for that. Well, you know, I hate my dad too. I hope you get over that. In the meantime, go read your Bible. This is what parents do. Abandoning this task, if you don't mind me being blunt about this, this is lazy, this is faithless. I don't feel like being a parent today. Parenting, real parenting, hard parenting, this parenting that Hal's talking about all the time, that's hard. It takes time. I watch a lot less TV that way. And now I have to quit eating donuts. What's the deal with that? We can do better than this. It is our job to do better than this. To provide spiritual nutrition for our families. I'm talking to a Sunday night crowd here, which may not be the best audience, I don't know. Because presumably you are in a position where you are training your children already, bringing them to church services on Sunday night, and God bless you for that. But we have to make sure that we are appreciative of what God has done for us. That the house full of children here, this quiver full of children, is a blessing from God. The text says in Psalm 127, verse 3, God gave us our children. And it is our job to make sure that they are taken care of. And that doesn't mean making sure they go to a good college, which may or may not be a good approach for them. It means getting them to heaven. Sometimes against their will. All right, speaking of against their will, let me give you one more. They won't do what I say. Maybe you have one of those relationships with your... I've heard of these. I'm not sure I've ever seen one. But I've heard of these relationships where parents tell their children what to do, and then the children do it? That must be really neat. You see it on TV every once in a while. Not so often these days. But occasionally, you hear about these dream families, Leave It to Beaver type families, right? Where the children behave themselves. They do what's right all the time. They always make good decisions because they always trust in mom and dad. They always let mom and dad make all the important stuff. They always tell the truth and et cetera, et cetera. And I got great kids. Okay, I don't want to be beating up my kids here, especially this one over here. But they're like I was, and like Tracy was, and like all of us were. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, right? Every child. This is the way we come packaged. And this rebellious nature that we have as children, especially as we start getting a little bit older, we start learning what being adult is all about, and it looks really interesting. We start getting willful. We start pushing back. Sometimes just for the sake of pushing back. And parents have to put up with this. Right? What are we going to do? They won't do what I'm telling them to do. I tell them to eat their vegetables. They won't eat their vegetables. And I say, to be teenagers. This is probably just as bad, if not worse, when they're little, right? I will not eat my broccoli, says the 5-year-old. I won't do it. May I digress for a second here? One of my issues with YouTube is that in our society, apparently we have parents who want to brag about how obnoxious their kids are. Why do we do this? My kid is on the floor, and I'm here with my phone, right? Yeah, he's really having time, isn't he? Look at that. Look at that. Then I post it for my, get 1,000 likes with my obnoxious kid. Why do we do that? Why do we brag about how obnoxious our children are? How rebellious our children are? We talk to Taylor and Kylie about this sometimes, how grateful we are that they, through very, very few, I'm not sure none, Tracy would be more qualified to say that, but very few public outbursts in Target or Walmart or whatever. You can humiliate me one time in public, but I assure you, you're not going to do it twice. I promise you that. It will not happen. If I look my child in the eye and say, "You are embarrassing me right now," they will get the message. Anyway, all that being said, it very well may be, I want you to consider this very carefully, that your child is not eating his vegetables, your child is not doing his exercise, your child is not doing whatever he needs to do physically because you're not telling him to do it the right way. This is not a child failure, this is a parent failure. It is our job to figure out the best way to accomplish the mission that we're talking about here. We need to be the parent. We are the voice of wisdom. We're in charge. We always have been. And we need to act like we're in charge. In Deuteronomy chapter 21, and other passages also, let me refer to that real quickly. Deuteronomy 21 and verse number 18. Kids are going to love this one. Somebody says, "Well, I've tried everything that I can do to fix my child's behavior. The child simply will not act in his own best interest. I don't know what to do. I have used every club in my bag. I've done everything I can do." And I say, "Have you stoned him?" Just asking. Because that's a Bible approach. Read what it says here. Buckle up, kids. "If any man has a stubborn and rebellious son and will not obey his father and his mother, and when they chastise him, he will not even listen to them, then his father and mother shall seize him and bring him out to the elders of the city at the gateway of his hometown. They will say to the elders of the city, 'This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He's a glutton and a drunkard.'" We'll come back to that in a second. "Then all the men of the city will stone him to death so that you will remove the evil from your midst, and all Israel will hear of it in fear." Okay, now that's some pretty intense parenting right there. And despite what I may sound like here, I'm not suggesting this as a plan X to motivate your children here. But this is what happened to rebellious children in times past. And notice here the example that he's using. We're not talking specifically about children who rebel because they wouldn't come to tabernacle services. We're not talking about children who did drugs. We're not talking about children who killed other children in the playground. The two specifics that he gives here are glutton and drunkard. They didn't eat the way they ought to. Kids, this is what happens when you don't eat your vegetables. You get stoned. Okay, that's a bit of an overstatement. But this is how serious these matters are. I'm not able to control my children's habits. Are you ready to kill them yet? And I mean really kill them. I'm not talking about killing them on Facebook. I mean really killing them. If you're not ready to kill them, then try something else. There is another approach. And in all of this, and this is not entirely said straight face, you realize this, I hope. All of this is done in love. All of this is done in compassion. All of this is done with wisdom and doing the right. We're trying to save our children, right? We don't want our children to be 100 pounds overweight when they're 24. We don't want them to be obese for the rest of their life. We don't want them to die of heart disease in their 40s. We want them to be healthy and vibrant and useful, productive in society. We want to put them on that path. This is for their sake as well as for ours, especially for their sake. So we owe it to them to find a way to make this work, to find a way to give them what they need. And again, if that's true in a carnal sense, surely it's far, far more true in a spiritual sense. How do I motivate my child is not interested in spiritual things. Most conversations that I have with parents with regard to that, the children are 18, 20, 25. The same children, I wanted to have the conversation when they were 14 and 16. And the parents weren't interested in the conversation at that point. The conversation should have happened when the children were 4 or 5. When they were first getting their feet wet, as it were, into spiritual things. Finding a way to get them to be motivated spiritually. Being parents, being in charge, being the hoary head that is found in the way of wisdom. Text is in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 32. We're the experts as far as the kids are concerned. And by the way, if you don't consider yourself an expert, maybe you ought to work on that. Maybe there's some growth opportunities for us here. I don't feel qualified to raise a child in spiritual matters. Well, maybe you should get qualified and get quickly qualified. Work hard. Unless you have something better to do. Unless you have something more important to do with your days. Children are naturally rebellious. The rod of discipline will beat it out of them. And again, this language the kids love here. And the rod isn't always a literal rod. I understand that. But it's our job to make sure they become less foolish. And this process is going to be painful to the children. They're going to hate this. We'll hate it too. But we need to make sure that making the child happy is not the goal. Making the child safe is the goal. Making them grow. Making them develop. Making them love the Lord. That's what we're trying to do. Always. And if we don't, and I've seen this happen, you've seen this happen too. If they take a rebellious attitude and they're not checked with regard to parents, it spreads. If they don't feel obligated to obey mom and dad, why should they obey God? Why should they obey their boss? Why should they obey the government? We are living in a society where people don't care about the rules. They think it's kind of cool to break the rules. They'll break as many of them as they think they can get away with. Where did they get that? They got that from mom and dad. Far more often than not. What we need to do as parents is train our children the way they should go. The proverb says when they're old, they won't depart from it. And that's a proverb. That's a generalization. It doesn't always work this way. But let's not give ourselves too much of a pass here, parents. If we do our job properly when the children are 4 and 5, when the children are 14 and 15, when the children grow up even and go off to college or work or whatever, if we are doing our job properly, we give them a much, much better chance of success than if we've done our job poorly. So which one do you want to do? You want to work a little harder or maybe a lot harder? and provide for your children's spiritual success? Or do you want to just loaf and watch Netflix and keep your fingers crossed that maybe the kids are going to actually be smarter than we are? We need to do better than this with whatever time we have. And parenting changes. You know, my children are in their 20s now. So the amount of influence I have over my children's values, my children's behavior has changed somewhat. I'm not sure exactly how much less, but I do know I have a lot less control than I used to have. Most of the important decisions now are being made by the children on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis. My work is not finished, but my work is nearing its completion. Jesus says in a very different context in John chapter 9, verse 4, that we're supposed to work the work of him who sent us. The night is coming when no man can work. We have opportunities as parents, especially when the children are little. We have opportunities to guide them in a healthy spiritual direction. Help them instill good habits in themselves. Help them value important things. Make good choices. The better we work in those hours, in those years, the better chance they're going to have to make these decisions on their own at some later time. That's the way it's supposed to work, at least. Surely, if working harder along these lines gives us a better chance of success in the most important job we are ever going to have, then surely working a little bit harder is what exactly we want to do. Now, I realize that the solution to this is to work harder. That's not a sermon that people like hearing. But more often than not, that's what we need to hear. That's what I need to hear. If I'd known how tough parenting was, I probably wouldn't have become a parent. You know, maybe it's just as well I didn't know. I don't know. But you all know what I'm talking about. This is hard work. And we need to apply ourselves to this. The children will forgive you in time. If you do it with love, if you do it with wisdom, that if you guide the child in the way that they should go, in the end, they will appreciate this. Or maybe not. Maybe they'll just be jerks. I don't know. But hopefully, they will love us for this. I'm going to stop at this time and offer the invitation to those who need to respond to it. If you are a child of God who is feeling the Lord's discipline, feeling the Lord's wrath even, if you are not where you ought to be and you want help in coming back to where you are, allow us to help with that. Allow us to be there for you, to lift you up, to forgive if necessary. If you have never been baptized in water for remission of sins, if you never accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, please think very seriously about your life. You know, maybe you've been told by your parents or friends or whatever that this is something that you need to do. Start thinking about this. Is this really what you need to do? Do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe that he died on the cross for your sins? And if so, put that faith to work by being baptized in water, as Jesus himself has told you to do. And begin this walk of faith that will end up with you in heaven. If there's anything we can do to help you with regard to these things, please respond while we stand and sing at this time.